Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Bob Enyart. Fred Williams is on assignment. There are two founders of the theory of evolution, specifically two co-discoverers of the principle of natural selection. They are Alfred Russel Wallace and Charles Darwin. Of course, to reinforce current scientific dogma, almost all attention is given to Darwin, and Wallace's role is downplayed or more often just ignored, and that's in large part because Wallace did not share Darwin's materialism and methodological naturalism. There's a science historian, Michael Flannery, and he's agreed to help our Real Science Radio audience and the hosts better understand this crucial part of the history of the theory of evolution. Michael Flannery teaches at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. He's a fellow over at the Discovery Institute. So, Professor Flannery, welcome to Real Science Radio.
Good to be here.
Well, thank you so very much. I've read a lot of what you've written, Michael, about Alfred Russel Wallace. Thank you for all that work.
I always appreciate having been read. So
yeah, that's
it's
right.
Nice to meet you by phone here.
Well, three of the things I'd love for us to talk about are Wallace's similarities with Darwin, his differences, the timing of that very important letter he sent to Charles Darwin in 1858, and also previous correspondence. But before we get to any of that, the word marginalia, you've studied the marginalia firsthand of Alfred Russel Wallace, right?
Oh, yes, from his personal library, yeah.
Yeah, could you tell us a little bit about that before we get into the controversy?
Well, it gives insights into Wallace's thinking. Typically, when you have a library book, you know, you like it to stay clean and not written in. But when it's from somebody who is important in the history of science or anything else, it's always a wonderful opportunity to go through the personal books that they owned. And it's even better if they were prone to mark them up,
yes,
write marginalia in them, make notes to themselves while they were reading. And Alfred Russel Wallace clearly did that. And the 470 volumes in his collection, which is at the University of Edinburgh, I had a wonderful opportunity to go through those, spent 2 weeks this past summer going through them. And it really gives a little window into his thought processes and where he was coming from and a lot of his ideas as he actually read them.
Professor Flannery, when I read a book, I cannot read without a pen in my hand. And if somebody lends me a book, I say, I don't want it. I need my own copy. Because if I'm going to invest this part of my life into reading this book, I might have to highlight the parts that stand out and refer back to them. And so it's with a pen in my hand that I read, and that's it. So
well, Wallace would have appreciated that because he certainly did a lot of highlighting of his own. Mm. So actually, it's a nice thing to do, and I do the same thing myself when I read.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. So did I exaggerate when I said in the introduction there are co-discoverers of the principle of natural selection, Alfred Russel Wallace and Charles Darwin? Is that valid?
That's absolutely valid. There's no question about it, and even Darwin himself recognized it. This came about when, you know, you talked about the similarities and differences between Wallace and Darwin, and I would say that the differences between the two men are far more striking than the similarities. But one of the similarities they had is they were both passionate naturalists. They loved investigating nature and made meticulous investigations of it. The discovery of natural selection, Darwin had been working on it for years quietly, at least since the 1840s. Wallace, however, it came to him in the midst of a malarial fever while he was, we think, on the island of Gilolo, which is near the island of Ternate, actually in the Malay Archipelago, in the Spice Islands out there in the South Pacific.
Well, like Charles Darwin went to the Galapagos Islands and
referred to
them, we have Wallace going to the South Pacific and the Spice Islands, and that's where he got a number of his insights.
Right, and he sent a letter to Darwin, we think probably in late February, early March of 1858, which is generally titled On the Tendency of Varieties to Depart Indefinitely from Their Original Type. And he sent that to Darwin, and Darwin said that he got it in June, and he was shocked, flabbergasted. He says, you know, I couldn't have written a more clear abstract myself on natural selection, and now I get this letter from this fellow named Wallace from some island I've never heard of in the Spice Islands, really laying out my theory. So he goes to his friends, Joseph Hooker. And Charles Lyell, and he says, what do I do with this? And so they said, look, you know, don't panic. You know, Darwin's afraid he's about to be scooped.
Right.
They decide that they're going to read Wallace's letter along with Darwin's manuscript and abstract, but they'll read Darwin's first, and then they'll read Wallace's, and they'll read it at the next meeting of the Linnaean Society. And so really, the modern theory of evolution by means of natural selection was unveiled at the Linnaean Society meeting on July 1st, 1858.
Now, when Charles Darwin sent a copy of this paper to his friend Charles Lyell, he wrote in the letter that accompanied the paper from Wallace, he wrote that, as you said, Michael, that Wallace could not have made a better short abstract.
Right.
Even his terms now stand as heads of my chapters.
Mm-hmm.
This is a clear admission from Darwin that this man, who turns out not to be a materialist, that this
right.
man has come upon the same fundamental theory of natural selection as Darwin himself.
Right. As a matter of fact, it's one of the things that prompted Darwin to really get his act together, sort of rush The Origin of the Species to press, because really by November of 1859, the press of Charles Murray of London is putting out the first edition of Origin of the Species. You know, Darwin knew from that point on he didn't have a lot of time to dally around. He was either going to get his full-blown theory out and published, or he might risk being scooped by Wallace. Who knows what Wallace had waiting in the wings.
Now, you mentioned these papers were read at the Linnaean Society of London. That's a reference, the name of that society, to Carl Linnaeus, who was a creationist and one of the fathers of modern biology.
That's true.
Along with others, there was, if I recall, a John Ray.
Yes. I mean, actually, most of the naturalists through most of history, in fact, if you look at the history of science in the Western world, it is predominated by creationists.
And so, yeah, the fathers of the physical sciences, for the most part, in the couple centuries before Darwin, and then in the century after Darwin, the vast majority of them were God-fearing, even biblical creationists.
Oh, yes, very much so.
So Darwin gets not only the letter you mentioned, but there was correspondence before that, right? In 1857, Darwin apparently received a letter from Wallace and a paper from Wallace that dated back to 1855. So that's 4 years before Origin of Species. And the paper was titled On the Law Which Has Regulated the Introduction of New Species.
That's really called the Sarawak Law Paper. And it's really the first description of evolutionary processes. They didn't have a mechanism for it yet, but it's really the first clear description of an evolutionary process in nature, and that is Wallace's Sarawak Law Paper. Now, curiously enough, Darwin didn't pay much attention to it. It was forwarded to him, and a number of people told him that, you know, somebody's sort of arcing up your path here. And Darwin just didn't quite get it. You know, if he had really looked back and thought about that Sarawak Law Paper, the letter he got in 1858 shouldn't have surprised him, really.
Yes. Now, some creationists, we can see how they might want to take this further than they should. They might want to say that Darwin stole these ideas from someone who believed in a super intelligence. But that's going too far, right?
I don't think Darwin stole any of these ideas from Wallace.
Right.
I've never been big on this Darwin conspiracy theory.
Right.
And one of the reasons I'm not really big on the theory that Darwin sort of plagiarized off of Wallace is that when you look at the theories more carefully, and see how they played out in their larger evolutionary schemes, they're really very different.
And that may bring us to some of the differences between Darwin and Wallace that you documented just wonderfully in your review of a book titled Wallace, Darwin, and the Origin of Species by a biologist, James Costa. What an interesting review you did of that book. And I've made my own outline of four or five of those differences. And so perhaps we could look at some of them. So the claim that some may make is an overstatement that Darwin is stealing Wallace's work. But on the other hand, Wallace is a refutation of the claim that unless you believe in methodological naturalism, materialism, that you are uneducated and it's a science stopper. It can't be a science stopper if the co-discoverer of the theory of evolution and natural selection rejected naturalism.
And there is a famous break where Wallace really overtly breaks with Darwin over his theory. And that comes about in a review of Charles Lyell's 10th edition of his Principles of Geology. It's published in 1869 in the April issue of Quarterly Review. And what Wallace says at the end of this review is that, you know, this is a paraphrase, but that we can account for a lot by naturalistic means in nature, but surely the mind of man is a special case. And the only thing that can explain the complexities of the human mind is an overruling intelligence. Now, it's what you and I would call God.
Yes,
but
right.
Clearly what Wallace is saying is that natural selection explains a fair amount in nature, but it doesn't explain everything in nature.
And for example, if you have a theory of origins that cannot account for human sentience, for the human mind, then you don't really have a theory of origins. Because to have a theory, I mean, that's more than a hypothesis. You need some kind of a robust mechanism for how you bring about self-awareness.
That's true. And later on, Wallace spent, I would say, over the last 40 or more years of his life, really burrowing into this question. In my opinion, one of the most important books that he wrote was his Grand Evolutionary Synthesis, which he wrote in 1910. And I think the very title tells you where Wallace went with this. And the title is The World of Life, A Manifestation of Power, Directive Mind, and Ultimate Purpose.
Wow.
And that's ultimately where he came to with his view of nature. He saw nature as teleological. He understood that the best way to appreciate nature, to understand its complexities, you have to understand that those complexities, in many cases, can only be explained really through intelligent or guided purpose. Undirected processes of chance and necessity are not sufficient explanations for much of the complexity in nature. And he's got a whole chapter on something like the cell, for example, the complexity of the cell. So in many ways, I think Wallace sort of almost predicts, or he's a presage for the work of people like Stephen Meyer and the Signature of the Cell and so on.
Yeah,
so,
we've interviewed Stephen on a few programs and just have thoroughly enjoyed that. Just as full disclosure, Michael, here we're biblical creationist, young earth, but we're so thankful for the work done at the Discovery Institute, where they are systematically dismantling the exaggerated claims of materialists. And so that's been a thrill. That book that you mentioned by Wallace from 1910, The World of Life, A Manifestation of Power, Mind, and Ultimate Purpose, you point out that in this book-length treatment of Wallace and Darwin by this biologist, James Costa, he doesn't even mention the title of this book. He doesn't even mention that Wallace wrote this book, The World of Life, about mind and ultimate purpose. That is an indication to me that he's in denial. He wanted to argue that really Wallace was not so much different than Darwin.
Yeah, and, you know, frankly, he's just off base. He can only do that by pulling things out of context, by quoting them out of context, and by ignoring a good body of Wallace's own work. Because Costa's problem is the book, like The World of Life, sort of embarrassingly inconvenient for his thesis.
Well, and
so his way of handling it is just to not mention it at all.
Yeah. Charles Darwin wrote a book called The Descent of Man. And Wallace wrote a book, Man's Place in the Universe. That's another title you point out that this biologist, James Costa, just completely omitted from his book-length treatment. And whereas in Darwin's book, The Descent of Man, there's just intensely racist passages as he describes the gap between the Negro and the gorilla as being not as large as the gap between other civilized men and so on.
Yes.
Whereas Wallace is talking about the super intelligence that brought about not only man's cognitive ability, but our moral capacity.
He does. And one of the points that Wallace wanted to make in Man's Place in the Universe, which he published in 1903, is that the universe, what he really makes is an early fine-tuning argument, that all of the things that are necessary to be in place to create complex life, and especially human life, are so fine-tuned and tightly regulated, that just can't be imagined. It's too improbable for those to just come together by chance or necessity. And what he really does is, there's another case of where he's essentially making an argument in advance, you know, 100 years before a book you may be familiar with that came out just a few years ago called The Privileged Planet.
Sure, that's by Guillermo Gonzalez, astronomer, and a co-author.
Jay Richards.
Right. And so whereas Wallace was prefiguring some of that, he was also updating the work of, let's say, William Paley in natural theology.
He was putting, I think, a much more intricate and scientific brush to it, whereas Paley's was an attempt at creating a natural theology, really sort of from a theologian's perspective. What Wallace was really striving for was a natural theology from a naturalist perspective that would fit in well with the emerging scientific theories and ideas that Wallace himself contributed to.
In fact, he made major contributions in areas like biogeography and anthropology, ecology, and evolutionary biology. It's an important synthesis for those who think, you know, matter and energy don't seem to be a good source for morality in human sentience, self-awareness. In fact, mathematics and logic and reason. So Wallace played an important part. And I think as a scientist, he helped to refute the argument that it's only the uninformed, the ignorant, who would reject a naturalistic explanation as Darwin might offer.
Yeah, I mean, that's just nonsense.
Correct.
The idea that intelligent design or, you know, the belief in a God or a creative being who created us, who created the world, who created all of the universe, that somehow is a science stopper is just ridiculous. Because let's just assume that Wallace suddenly, which I don't believe is true, but let's just say Wallace suddenly came to his theory in 1869 that only an overruling intelligence can explain the complexities of the human mind. Well, if that's a science stopper, all of his science work should have ceased. But it didn't.
Right, of
course.
In
1876, his geographical distribution of animals really became the seminal work in the development of biogeography. In 1889, he writes Darwinism, an exposition of the theory of natural selection. And he writes, you know, extensive biological and scientific papers for years after his break in 1869. I certainly didn't stop him from doing science.
Professor Flannery, perhaps we could hit on some of the differences that you highlight between Wallace and Darwin. Wallace rejected Darwin's reference to domestic breeding as an example of his mechanism for the origin of species. When Wallace rejected that, he showed tremendous foresight, because there's a great realization today that domestic breeding of dogs or cattle is a far cry from the development of new organs and new higher level functions like flight or echolocation and so on. You breed dogs and you march right into barriers that are right there in the genetics and the epigenetics.
Right. And what Wallace pointed out to Darwin, and he always disagreed with Darwin. I mean, in the letters that Wallace wrote to Darwin, he said, these domestic breeding examples you give as, you know, sort of evolution in action is just wrong. He says, because most domestic breeds, if they're left to their own devices, will either revert to their original type or they'll perish.
Mm-hmm.
None of them can exist on their own. And he points out that the breeding examples that you give as natural selection in action really give evidence of a designer or somebody who is choosing and picking out the features of the kind of breed that they want to get, whether it's a polter pigeon or a plow horse
so
or whatever.
That it's evidence of purpose and intention.
Right.
Evidence of intelligence and design. Then also, Wallace never would look at people that Darwin would like to point to savages and compare them to apes. I've mentioned that already. Wallace never sunk to that level. He denied this kinship that Darwin saw between humans and other species. Wallace rejected that.
Absolutely. And I think there's a reason for that. And the reason for that is when you look at the amount of field experience they had, it was very different. You know, Wallace had more than twice the field experience that Darwin did. And so, like, what Darwin did for 5 years, from December of 1831 to October of 1836, he's on the Beagle, right? And he's going around with Captain Fitzroy, and he's basically skirting continents and going into islands like the Galapagos, but he's basically staying with the ship, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Wallace, he spent from April of 1848 to October of 1852 living among the Indians of the Wapase River Valley, in the Amazon River Valley. He goes back to England for a couple of years. He leaves in 1854 and doesn't come back to England until the spring of 1862, which he spends in the Malay Archipelago living among the natives. And so when you live with people for extended periods of time, you get to see them as human beings.
Right.
He marveled at the complexity of these people that we would otherwise consider to be primitive, and he noted that their art, their crafts, their cultures.
Well, their language is so sophisticated. And
yes.
Of course.
And so Wallace never went down that racist path because he had lived with these people for too long.
And I think Darwin had a native, it might have been a Fuegian, am I saying that right?
Yeah.
On board with him for a while. And actually began to treat him as a friend, but then later began to reorient that relationship to distance that man and his, you know, his own tribe from civilized man.
Well, there's no doubt that Darwin tended to see human beings in racial categories.
Oh, yeah.
And that he saw those racial categories as hierarchical.
Yeah.
And some so-called, put in quotes, better than others.
So we're about out of time, Professor Michael Flannery. You point out that in Origin, you might be quoting another researcher, Darwin says my theory 57 times, my theory. He speaks of my doctrines, almost like he's out of control in this overly possessive human frailty to deny Wallace his place in the history of science.
Yes, I believe Ben Weicker did a very fine biography of Darwin, and he actually went through Origin and counted the number of times that Darwin mentioned my theory.
So here we are a century and a half later, and the problems that Darwin had, the origin of the human mind, the origin of life itself, of sentience, we're no closer. The evolutionists have made about zero progress over all this time on these major issues. And so Alfred Russel Wallace, his insight looms as significant today as it did back when he was causing Darwin sleepless nights.
Yes, I think that's very true. And I think, in a sense, today, when we look at the intelligent design movement, and we see people like Mike Behe, researchers like Stephen Meyer, Jonathan Wells, and many others,
Paul Nelson,
they are really carrying forward sort of the proto-ideas that were first initiated by Wallace 100 years ago.
Yeah, so we can write a rough algorithm for how a protein might assemble. You know, given certain resources and enough time, like maybe trillions of universes worth of time, but there is no rough algorithm on how self-awareness arises from atoms, from matter.
No, there's not.
There's no rough algorithm, and there never will be, because you have to start.
No, there's not, and one might say, and it would be interesting if we start looking at these aspects in terms of information and design apparatus, we might at least come to a better appreciation of how these mechanisms work. Of course, it's all a reflection, from Christian standpoint, which I'm a Christian, is that we are made in the image of God. That really does explain a great deal,
yes.
I think.
And so we're not just body, we're body, soul, and spirit, and we don't just have a brain, we also have a mind. Professor Flannery, we're out of time. We would like to, in our show summary, link to your work. Is it best to link to your writings over in the family of websites from the Discovery Institute? Is that the best way to go?
Yes, alfredwallace.org is a website where I have a lot of my Wallace research listed.
Well, we will do that. And what an honor to have you on after reading you, Michael Flannery. It's really a thrill to get to talk with you.
Well, thanks. I'm glad you read my review of Costa, because he was pretty disappointing, actually.
Yeah, I think so. We expect better, you know, but often we don't get it. Thank you so very much.
All right. Thank you. Good to talk to you.
Okay, you're welcome. That's Professor Michael Flannery with the Discovery Institute and also at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. And this is Bob Enyart for Fred Williams and Real Science Radio. Our website, realscienceradio.com. If you appreciate the show, please go to our store, click on the science department, and you could subscribe or purchase our resources, make donations, help us reach more people. May God bless you.
That's what I'm talking about.